Good to see everyone, and I would like to invite you to take your Bibles, open them along with me to the Gospel of Luke in chapter 9. Luke chapter 9, we're going to be reading there together in just a few moments. Again, before we get started, we want to welcome those who are able to be with us. I don't have quite as many visitors as this morning, but we still have several who are able to be here for afternoon worship, and we appreciate the presence of each one. You know, to be perfectly honest, I am still not on Eastern Standard Time. And so I really wasn't all that awake this morning. And it's haunted me all afternoon, the things that I wish that I would have said this morning. For starters, simple things like, thank you. Thank you for being willing to send and support me on this trip and for the financial support from the group here that made that possible. That seemed like a pretty big thing to have left out. Another thing, I missed all of you. And I'm really glad to be back. That was also something that seemed like it would be important to mention. You know, while I was there, you kind of get caught up in things and you get in the flow and you develop your own work cycle because you're there for so long. And so, you know, you miss people back home, but you're also concentrating and working on the thing that's ahead of you. So it's not always on your mind, but I'll tell you, on the very last day that we were there, the last Bible study that we had, someone there said, let's sing Take the Name of Jesus With You, like we always do here at the end of our gospel meetings. And I thought, well, that did it. It's time to go home. And so I did. And so it's good to be back. There is nowhere else I would rather be than with you opening up God's Word together. And I hope that we will have some encouragement this afternoon as we do that. We are going to be picking up in verse 18 of chapter 9. There are a few things that we want to remind ourselves of as far as context for the chapter so that we remember what it is that we're looking at and what really has led up to this important event that's going to be asked in our chapter. If you'll remember, the chapter so far has really been one of miraculous activity. You know, a lot of times we see the ebb and flow between the miracles and the teaching, but by and large, chapter 9 had a great emphasis on the miraculous. Of course, that led up to, in the last section, the feeding of the 5,000. But that's not by far the only miracle that's mentioned in the chapter. In fact, it begins with Jesus giving that same kind of authority to go out and perform miracles to all of his disciples, the 12, and sent them out. And they come back and they have a great report of the things that they have done. But all of that has been for a purpose. It's leading up to something. The message that they had was the announcement of the coming kingdom. And so what are people going to do with it? They've been hearing the message. They've seen the miracles performed. Now what? You see, lines are being drawn. The kingdom is coming. And everyone who's been listening to this message, now they're reaching a point where they're going to have to decide, what are we going to do with it? What do we think about the message that's being preached? And more importantly, what do we think about the one who is preaching this message? And so it's within that context that Jesus is going to ask this core question in verse 18 and following. And really, the conversations that take place after that raise some more important questions, not just for the disciples then, but for those of us who wish to be disciples today. So with that in mind, let's read just the first couple of verses together, beginning in verse 18 of Luke chapter 9. Let's read through verse 20 together. It says, "And it happened that while he was praying alone, the disciples were with him, and he questioned them, saying, 'Who do the people say that I am?' They answered and said, 'John the Baptist.' And others say, 'Elijah,' but others that one of the prophets of old has risen again. And he said to them, 'But who do you say that I am?' And Peter answered and said, 'The Christ of God.'" Let's pause there for just a moment. I want us to consider the circumstances, again, like we've mentioned, that are surrounding this question. Why is it that Jesus is just now asking his disciples this question? What about these events that we've reviewed have prompted this examination of the disciples, really his closest followers? Well, I think about all of the things that the disciples have witnessed up to this point. They've been with Jesus in an up close and personal way. That they've heard the things that he's taught. And so they've had opportunity to listen and compare his teaching with what they've heard from others and what they could read in the scriptures for themselves. They have seen the Lord interact with people. They've seen him not only in the homes of friends and those who are warm and welcoming, they've seen him interact with his enemies and those who would wish him harm. And again, perhaps most impressively, they have seen the Lord work all manner of miracles and signs and wonders up to this point, restoring the sight to the blind, causing the deaf to hear, the lame to walk. And on top of that, they have been given that kind of authority themselves. They've gone out and they've witnessed firsthand what it means to be a representative or one who is sent out on behalf of this Jesus. As we said a moment ago, now we're getting to the point where they have to ask, so what? But what of it? What does it all mean? What's it pointing to? What has all of this been communicating about who Jesus is and the things that he might be claiming about himself? And most importantly for them, have they learned the answer? But the question comes in two parts. And so first, he asks, who do the crowds say that I am? Well, what about all of those crowds who have followed him from district to district, region to region, and they've heard the teaching, they've seen the miracles? Who do they say? Well, maybe John the Baptist, maybe Elijah, or at least maybe one of the prophets. And you know, you stop and think about it, and those aren't necessarily what we would call bad answers. They're very least not insulting answers. They're not going around like the Pharisees and saying, you know, you're in league with the demons. None of us would be insulted to be compared to those people. But the problem is that while all of those were good answers, none of them were the right answer. None of them were the truth. I think there are a couple of important truths that are illustrated in this section. The first of which is that there are some people who spend an enormous portion of their lives being exposed to the evidence of Jesus, hearing testimony about Jesus, and they never have any reaction to him at all. They never wrestle with the question of who is Jesus and what does it mean? And then there's another group. People who spend their lives coming into contact with the evidence for Jesus, seeing his people, and they're always sort of close, like the crowds. They'll say something good about Jesus, they'll say something positive about him, but they never take the full step of saying who he really is, and then changing their lives accordingly to what that would mean for them. Neither of those are acceptable. You cannot encounter the works of Christ and leave unchanged. And there is only one acceptable response to who he is. So, we have a follow-up in verses 21 and 22. But he warned them and instructed them not to tell this to anyone, saying, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised up on the third day." Well, now comes the time for the disciples to answer. Who do you say that I am? I imagine the tension that was built. Well, who's going to be the first one to say something? And Peter speaks up and has this wonderful confession. He gets it right. This is the truth. But then what does Jesus say? Well, following Peter's confession, he has what, to me at least, is a rather unusual command. Don't tell anyone. Don't let anybody know what you know. At least not yet. Why would Jesus do that? Why would Jesus tell them to keep something a secret, especially when this is something that Jesus has essentially been teaching himself and his words and his actions. Consider for a moment that while in some ways Jesus' teaching had been very bold and straightforward, in many ways it had that element of allowing people to draw their own conclusions. He was pointing to himself through Moses and the prophets. But the teaching was laid out for the people to examine what they saw in the scriptures and come to the conclusion themselves that he was the one that he had been, that they had been waiting for. As of yet, there was no announcement being made in the streets. Jesus is not walking up and down the streets of the cities banging on the drum saying, "I am the Christ." At least not in those words. Now his actions and the things that he taught, if anybody were to examine those with an honest heart and compare it to what was written in Moses and the prophets, they would draw that conclusion. But up to this point, Jesus had not been nearly so straightforward as to simply come out and say to the crowds, "I am the Christ." Now there's going to come a time when Jesus will say, "Yes, I am He." And when He does, the reaction is going to be in the most violent terms, as this will be the grounds that those will say, "Crucify Him." And the danger and the violence that Jesus speaks of in these verses that we're about to read, it's going to extend to those who confess the truth of who Jesus is. Beginning in verse 23, "And he was saying to them all, 'If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake, he is the one who will save it. For what is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. But I say to you truthfully, there are some of those standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God." In considering Jesus' instructions, first, let's take a moment to think about what it is that he is saying that will be required of those who will follow him as the Christ. This idea of taking up your cross. How do we normally use that phrase, at least in our culture? Well, I was on my way home from work today. I got stuck in traffic in downtown Atlanta. Well, we all have our cross to bear. You know, my in-laws are going to be coming this weekend. Well, we all have our cross to bear. Or, you know, I've been sick. I got the flu last week and it's lingered around a little longer than I expected. Well, we all have our cross to bear. It sort of developed this idea today in our culture, if we're not careful, that the cross is sort of this multi-purpose metaphor for being inconvenienced. You know, any degree of mild suffering or drawback today, well, you know, we've all got crosses to bear. You know, that's not what a cross is used for. The cross was not a Swiss Army knife with a whole lot of different uses. The cross is good for one thing, and that's killing people. It's not good for anything else. And so when Jesus speaks of the cost of discipleship, of being willing to take up your cross, he's got one thing in mind. You need to be ready to give up your life if you're going to be a part of this kingdom. If you're going to be willing to say that this man, this is Jesus, he is the Christ of God, you need to be willing to give up your life. You need to be ready to do so in the most literal sense possible, because a time was coming, and it would be coming soon for those who were listening to him, that they were going to spread that message that they were supposed to keep to themselves for now, They were going to spread it all over the earth. And when that time came, would they still be willing to identify Jesus as the Christ of God? Would Peter and the rest of them still be willing to identify who Jesus was when it would cost them everything? What about us? Are we willing to name the name of Christ and say who Jesus is in our world, in our culture, regardless of what it may cost us? Because depending on the answer that we give, verse 26 is either very exciting, very terrifying. Imagine, for a brief moment respite of some sort of physical suffering or persecution, we disown the name of Christ. And for that brief moment of alleviation here on this world, we choose to miss out on everything. Imagine choosing to give up everything for nothing. Jesus says that those who are ashamed of Him in this life, that's exactly what they've done. Because when He comes in glory, those who are ashamed of Him, He won't know who they are. But of course, the opposite of that is true as well, and that's the exciting part. Thinking about those who persevere, those who would answer, yes, I am willing to point to Jesus as the Christ, no matter the time or the situation or circumstance, having the joy of knowing that when the Son of Man comes in the glory of His Father and of those angels, He will not be ashamed of us, that He claims us as His own. In this section, verse 27 lets them know that that time would be coming very soon when they would have an opportunity to put these words to the test. Incidentally, verse 27 you should mark as having some excellent applications in talking to any of your friends and neighbors who are still expecting the kingdom to come in some form here on earth. But in its context, this continues and finishes Jesus' warnings to His disciple. Not only would there be some of those standing there who would not taste death until the kingdom came, but when the kingdom arrived, it would be the death of some of those who were standing there. Would they still be willing to name the name of Christ when that came? Well, I think in the following verses, what the disciples receive are instructions, but also encouragement. Because as we pick up in verse 28, it says, some 8 days after these sayings, He took along Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. And while He was praying, the appearance of His face became different, and His clothing became white and gleaming. And behold, two men were talking with Him, and they were Moses and Elijah, who, appearing in glory, were speaking of His departure, which He was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Let's pause there for a moment. I don't think that it's any coincidence that all of these things take place after the sayings that are recorded earlier in the chapter. In fact, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all of these things are recorded. The transfiguration is recorded in each gospel after this good confession on the part of Peter and the warnings that Jesus gives following them. I don't think it's a coincidence that after that admonition about the coming kingdom, that the cost being so high to partake, that they get to see just a glimpse of that glory that Jesus is going to come in. Consider the impact that that would have on them. Consider the impact of their testimony as they told others about what they saw and being willing to hold on and persevere. But as to the event itself, Jesus, following His customary practice that we've already seen in verse 18 of prayer, brings along what we sometimes think of as an inner circle among the disciples. They take them up on the mountain and they witness something extraordinary. I don't know exactly, precisely what it was they saw, other than, as we mentioned, it's some small taste of the Lord's glory. Elijah and Moses, who are said to be there, are said to have appeared in glory or splendor in verse 31. Peter, writing about these things in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 16, would describe the experience of the disciples who were there as having beheld or been eyewitnesses of the majesty of Christ. So to be sure, this was an awesome sight to behold. There was a purpose to it. There was meaning behind this. Moses and Elijah had business to discuss. The text tells us that it pertained to his departure and the work at Jerusalem. What does that mean? Well, first, we recall where we are in the ministry of Jesus. We're closing in on that retirement period, and we're getting closer and closer to his death. And so his task is always on his mind. And so I think to some degree there's encouragement being offered there. But they're not there to tell him about what he's going to do. They're not there to give him instructions. The text also speaks about the work or what he was going to accomplish in Jerusalem. That word accomplish has the sense of fulfilling or satisfying. And so the NASB uses accomplish, but when you read that, think about speaking about the things that Jesus came to fulfill or accomplish. As Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, he did not come to abolish the law and the prophets. He did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. And here on the mountain, we have a visual representation of Jesus doing just that. In verse 32, now Peter and his companions had been overcome with sleep. But when they were fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. And as these were leaving him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three tabernacles, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah," not realizing what he was saying. While he was still saying this, a cloud formed and began to overshadow them. They were afraid as they entered the cloud. Then a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him." And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. They kept silent and reported to no one in those days any of the things which they had seen. I'll tell you, in verse 32, it's easy for us to get carried away with bashing poor old Peter, always seeming to be asleep and always shooting off at the hip. But we do that as though we would have spoken in a more measured or wise way if we had been there ourselves. I think we can understand to a degree Peter's desire for this experience to be drawn out a little bit more. I think that's what he is saying in the text. You know, he has been asleep. He wakes up and somehow or another he recognizes Moses and Elijah and they're on their way out. You know, Lord, let's put up some tents and prolong this experience. And so the problem with his request was not that perhaps he wanted it to last a little bit longer. The problem with his request was that what they were seeing, this was not a meeting of three equals. Moses was great as a leader of Egypt. Moses was great as the deliverer of the law. The time of Moses was gone and the law was fading. Elijah was great and powerful as a prophet. But it's not the time of Elijah anymore. And someone who is greater in every sense possible than Elijah is here. As the author says in Hebrews chapter 1, God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. The truth that is being declared on the Mount of Transfiguration in no uncertain terms is to look at Jesus. This is the place where truth can be found. This is the place where life can be found. And there is no other place where you can find these things. That is really the lesson of this section that runs from 18 to 36, beginning with the realization of who the Christ is. What does this all mean? What does it say about Jesus? What are you going to do with that? Are you going to listen to Him? As we said at the beginning, I believe that these conversations raise some important points for us as disciples as well. And in our last few moments, I would like us to consider some of those as points of application that we can take with us throughout the week. First and foremost, beginning with the same question that Jesus asked of his followers, who is Jesus to you? Who is Jesus to each one of us who are gathered here this afternoon? Do you fall into that category of those who have continued to see the evidence for so long in your life, but you haven't responded to it? You haven't done anything with it yet? You don't see what it says about Jesus? Do you know of Him, but you still don't recognize Him as Lord? As we said earlier, those aren't acceptable options. There's only one proper reaction to coming to a knowledge of who Jesus is, of seeing Him as the Christ of God and living a life that reflects that. We may have some who still need to take that step. But what about those of us who have? Are we taking up our cross? Not in the flippant sense of our culture and society, but in the sense by which Jesus demands that our lives belong to Him. If I believe in Jesus as the Christ, does it show in my life? Could it be said of me, as Paul claims of himself, that when people look at us, who do they see? Do they see me? Or do they see Christ living in me? If I've taken up my cross, and my life is already given to the Lord, that answer should be easy. Finally, as the Father commended to those disciples, demanded of those disciples, am I listening to Him? Is the voice of Jesus the only voice that I allow to dictate my life and lead my life? Am I being led through His Word? If not, what am I going to do to change it? I appreciate your attention this afternoon. As we consider these questions and needs that you know about yourself, we take these few moments to extend the invitation to those who are here. For those who have never responded to the Lord, the opportunity is yours. Do not let it pass you by. And for those who have, and perhaps by these verses or things that only you know about, you are stirred to be a better follower of Christ, and you would like the prayers of the brethren here, I know we would be glad to offer them. If we can help you, we can encourage you this afternoon. I ask that you come.